Well, as many of you guys know, if you've been part of Mosaic for any given period of time, you know that I wholeheartedly believe that we have been created for an extraordinary life, for an uncommon life, because in our restoration, after we were rescued, we have been called into imaging God once again to the world, to carrying the uncommon reality of His rescue and redemption into the world. And so by definition, we are called into a life that is not going to look like an ordinary life. It is going to look like the life of Jesus. And we are called into this because the human race is drawn to uncommon things. We are drawn to extraordinary stories. We are drawn to places and times when it seems that a human being is able to breach the bounds of what should be naturally possible, to do the impossible, to step into a life that doesn't seem to be able to happen. We see this in numerous environments in which we live. I mean, in the environment of sport, we see this a lot, right? I mean, that first time when a basketball player seems to defy gravity and jump further than any man should ever be able to jump, we all go, wow, something just emerged. The first time a golfer hits that golf ball and it flies way further than any golf ball has ever flown before, we go, wait a second, how's that possible? The first time the 100-meter dash is done under 10 seconds, and we go, what? We thought that would not be humanly possible. And we are drawn to those times and those places when the impossible seems to emerge. We're even drawn to that in entertainment, aren't we? I mean, when you watch entertainment, sometimes in the entertainment field, you bump into these men and women that have trained their heart, their minds and their hands to be able to be so skilled that they can create illusions before us, things that seem to do impossible things. And deep down, we know that what they're doing is a trick. We know it. We're like, they're doing something because that what they're doing is not possible, but we can't figure the trick out. And so what are we? We're drawn into that. We're captivated by that because we're like, as much as we know, that's not possible. And we know it's a trick. It's just so fun to watch, isn't it? Isn't it amazing to watch someone do what is seemingly impossible? I want to illustrate that for you, just so you can understand what I'm getting at here. I've asked one of my friends, Jeff, who is over at our Disney Walt Disney World Mosaic campus, and he's part of that campus, and he has trained himself over the years to be a skilled illusionist, and I'm going to allow him to show you how you can make the impossible seem possible when you know what you're doing. So would you welcome Jeff as he comes on up here.
Thank you. You guys ready to have some fun? All right, I'll fix that right now. How about a round of applause for no reason? Thank you. All right, watch close. Any questions so far? We good? My name is Jeff Kaler. I'm a magician. I'm just going to do a few things for you here today. We're going to do a little illusion with three ropes. Everyone go, ooh. Nice. We have one long rope. It's about the length of my leg. Go ahead and check that out. Make sure that's a normal rope. No magnets, trapdoors, mirrors. We have a medium rope. It's about the length of my arm. Go ahead and check that out. Very good. We have a small rope. It's about the length of my foot. Okay, go ahead and check that out over there. How's that long rope looking? Throw that up here. Nice throw. Awesome. How's that little rope looking? Good. How about that medium rope? He's actually chewing his rope. Throw that up here. All right, three ropes, three different lengths. In a few seconds, they're actually going to start to look like they're the same length. All right, now hold your applause. Great. Because how could the small rope look like the medium rope, which looks like the long rope? That makes no sense, right? So we'll get rid of one of them. That way we just have two. All right, let's just start over, okay? Start over. Just watch the ends of the rope here. Watch this end. As it hops over to here. Yeah. We'll do it again. Thank you. Slow motion. Slow motion. Just like that. You gotta be careful though, because sometimes the ends come off the rope and you're left with just a loop of rope. Thank you. It's okay, you can take the ends and throw them back onto the rope like that if you want. And it also works with static electricity. If we just go like this, and just like that, goes back to a loop of rope. Thank you. But it's okay, I carry extra ends. Oh wait, we put them on the wrong side. There we go. Okay. How many ropes do we start with?
Three,
that's one. That's two. Three ropes, right? We had a really small one. We had a medium one. And we had one really long one, right? Now at the count of three, these three ropes will go back to their original lengths. And you will all want to applaud. Three, two, one. There's that long one. There's that medium one. There's the short one. Thank you. Want to see one more? All right. Everyone go like this. Go like this. Go like this. No, I'm just kidding. No. Put your thumbs down like this. Put your right hand over your left hand like that. And lock your hands together. Okay? Make sure your thumbs are down. Kind of point them at the ground. Okay? Like that. And wiggle them. Okay? Now at the count of three, go like this. Ready? One, two, three. All right, you got to loosen up. We'll do it again. We'll do it again. You got to be really loose. So just kind of, I'm just going like that. I'm messing with you. All right, go like this. Go like this. Go like this. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Jeff. That's awesome, man. You get what I'm saying? Do you see how easy it is to captivate us when somebody is able to do something that we know is an illusion, and yet simultaneously we're staring at it and we're like, that's not possible. That's not possible. And we are captivated by that even when we know that it is skilled hands that are doing that. Can you imagine what it might have been like, what it might be like to be able to be in a place, in a moment, where somebody is doing something, but instead of it being an illusion, instead of it being something we know is the work of skilled hands, it is actually the effecting of a power that does things that defy the natural, that we call supernatural. Things where somebody that is lame suddenly walks, or somebody that is blind suddenly sees. Can you imagine what it might be like to be in a place where you are watching the supernatural take place before your very eyes, and as much as you go, that can't be real, it absolutely is real. That's got to be something. That's got to be crazy cool in some really awesome ways. As we journey through the story of the book of Acts, we bump into a fascinating story. It's found in the book of Acts chapter 5, and I want you guys to turn there with me, and I want to show you what I mean. In Acts chapter 5, which is on page 593 of our Bibles, which are under the seats if you don't have one of your own Bibles with you. In Acts chapter 5, The passage begins with the story of Ananias and Sapphira, which if you weren't here for, you should go back and podcast again because it's a critical story even to this piece. But Ananias and Sapphira came into the community of God that the Spirit of God was birthing, this group of people that were full of the Spirit, and they tried to utilize the community for their benefit in a very sort of scamming, tricky sort of way. And some crazy stuff happened, supernatural stuff. The Spirit of God revealed their deception, and then because of their deception, they died. Yes, that's right. It was a disturbing story to read and to work through. But we worked through that, and as a result of their death, because of this deception that they created, and because of what God was showing the people and the community of God at that time, there were these people outside of the community that suddenly took it very seriously about whether they should or should not join this community. And that's where we begin in verse 12 of chapter 5. It's coming off the heels of Ananias and Sapphira, and it says, "Now many signs and wonders were regularly done among the people by the hands of the apostles. And they were all together in Solomon's portico. None of the rest dared join them, but the people held them in high esteem." So there it is. These people on the outside of the biblical community that do not yet know and have not professed faith to Jesus Christ, they love the idea of the community. They love what the community can give to them, but now they don't want in on the community anymore because they're like, that's very scary. It's kind of like our Western culture and our American church. Lots of people entering into church because of what the church can give them. But can you imagine if it was like, hey, if you happen to deceive us, you might die? That might reshape the way people think of going to church, right? And that's kind of what's happening here. The people on the outside are going, that's not a place you just walk into, jump in, and benefit from. But there was also this group of people. Verse 14, "And more than ever, believers were added to the Lord, multitudes of both men and women." So you have two stories happening simultaneously. The people on the outside not wanting to jump into this community just to benefit from it or just to get something from it or even just to be part of it. But there are other people that come to know Jesus, receive the Spirit of God and go, whoa, I want in regardless of that risk factor. You see, the genuine faith that was professed in Christ drove them deeply into community, despite the fact that they knew that community had an air of danger to it. You couldn't just walk into it. And then it describes this crazy story. So multitudes of both men and women are coming to know Jesus, adding to the community, so that they even, verse 15, so that they even carried out the sick into the streets and laid them on cots and mats, that as Peter came by, at least his shadow might fall on some of them. Did you read that? Did you read what that just said? Okay, let me explain it just in case you missed it. Apparently at this stage in the story, when Peter walked down the street and his shadow crossed over someone that was sick, they were healed. Are you kidding me? I mean, are you kidding me? It's one thing like, oh, healed, but this is like, oh, Peter's coming, quick, shadow, awesome, healed. Whew. I mean, that is insane. And as though that's not enough, it says this, "The people also gathered from the towns around Jerusalem, bringing the sick and those afflicted with unclean spirits, and they were all healed." You came to this community, you were sick, you had a demonic spirit, you were healed. Is that weird? Does that weird you out? Does that cause you just to go, what? See, that passage, it begs a lot of questions for me. Doesn't it for you? It starts begging all sorts of things from me. I start thinking to myself, okay, what is happening here? Why is it happening here? How is it happening here? What has it got to do with me? How does it relate to my life? How does it relate to our life? How does it fit into our context? Does it fit into our context? Is it for us? Is it not? If it is, how, where, what? If it's not, why not? See, these kinds of passages, they launch us into a set of questions that start boggling the mind, and we have to start wrestling through some crazy stuff. So the safest thing to do is to skip right over that passage and just to move on to the next story and to leave that laying low and just ignore it. So let's turn to Acts chapter 5. No, I'm kidding. That's a joke. We are actually going to jump into this reality. We are going to step into the question of the supernatural and ask ourselves, does that reality, the miracle, signs and wonders that seemed at this moment to be happening in the community almost commonplace? Many signs and wonders were done at the hands of the apostles among the people. They brought their sick and they were healed. There seems to be this supernatural reality that is unfolding here. And the question we have to ask ourselves is, does it fit into our current story, our current context? And if it does, how does it fit? Where does it fit? What should we expect from it? Is it gone? Is it here? If it's here, can we access it? These are great questions. And if we're going to start asking the kinds of questions about fitting a biblical reality into our story, we must always take the time to ask the question, what context is that story currently fitting into its own current context? Because if we don't know where miracle signs and wonders are fitting into the context of the church that we just read it in, then we should not dare ask, how does it fit into our context? If we start dealing with biblical realities like miracle signs and wonders exclusively of the context they're in, and we throw them in and we say, how can we have them here? Where do they fit? We will come up with some very limited conclusions and often dangerous conclusions. We will begin to try to process formulas that can produce these kinds of things, very dangerous territory. Or we will assume that since we do not see them, they cannot be here and they must not be for us. Limited conclusions we may land on. But if we dig into what is happening in the context and then we extract from that how that fits into our context, we may just land on exactly what it is God wants us to know about these kinds of realities. So what is the context of this particular event in Acts chapter 5? We know we've seen scatterings of some miraculous events early on in the book of Acts, and now it says signs and wonders were being done at the hands of the apostles, and everyone that brought the sick, they were healed. This is a natural part of this biblical community now. How did this emerge? Where did these miracles come from? Why are they here? Well, let's go back for a moment. Beginning of the book of Acts, right? Where are we? We're with Jesus. He is with his disciples. He is about to ascend into heaven. He has returned from the dead. He has spent time with them after returning from the dead. It's a pretty miraculous reality, right? He is now going to literally move into the other realm, into eternity before their very eyes. Whoa! It's going to be awesome. But right before he does, he says to them, I am going to give you the mission that has been unfolding since the beginning of human history. I am going to give you the kingdom of God and the keys to that kingdom to carry it into the rest of the human story and make the redemptive reality of Jesus known. And I am going to empower you to be able to accomplish that. You're going to do it in Jerusalem, then in Judea and Samaria, and then to the ends of the earth, skipping over not only geographical boundaries, but generational boundaries. Wow. And remember the context in which Jesus is telling them this, right? The Jewish leadership of that day, the Sanhedrin, with some of the Pharisaical movement involved, was anti-Jesus. So first in Jerusalem, they had to battle the reality of Annas and Caiaphas and the high priestly movement, and those people wanted to kill them. So that was not a small task. Then, if they should overcome that reality, oh wait, what happened next? The Roman Empire was waiting for them. The Roman Empire! That's what the gospel was supposed to go and flourish in. Are you kidding me? So as the guys walk away from Jesus laying this out, there was this deep sense by the declaration of Christ that you will not accomplish this incredible, impossible reality unless you are empowered by an incredible power. And Jesus says to them, I want you to go and wait. And when you go and wait, I am going to send you the Spirit of God. He's going to come. and he's going to fill you, and you're going to have him. And you see, for the disciples in that moment, if you remember, this was a huge deal because Jesus, when he came to planet Earth, he voluntarily set aside his divine attributes, that is, his ability to express his divinity in the powers that come with the divine. Though he could do that, he voluntarily set that aside so that he could function in his humanity. It was a crazy awesome thing that he did for us. But when he enters into his ministry in the baptism, the Spirit of God comes down and descends on him in the form of a dove, and the voice of the Father declares his authority over his Son, and Jesus functions functionally under the authority of the Father by the power of the Spirit. He does not function under his own authority and under his own power. Though he could, he doesn't. And he becomes for us the perfect Spirit-filled man. We watch him function under the authority of God in the power of the Spirit, despite the fact that he is wholly divine, but he functions in his humanity. And we watch him do extraordinary things under the power of the Spirit by the authority of the Father. And all the way, not only to his death, but his resurrection itself, he was resurrected by the Spirit. See? Now he's resurrected, and so now he's no longer functioning in his humanity. He is functioning in his divinity. When he's standing here with the disciples, it is Jesus in his glorified form, at least what we saw as his glorified form in that context. And he ascends into heaven, and he says, the Spirit that was empowering me this whole time that you walked with me, he will now come and empower you. And then at Pentecost, in the very next chapter, we see the guys sitting around, and the Spirit of God comes in a powerful display, a tangible display, to declare to them in very tangible ways, I'm here and I've come, just in case somebody goes, I feel like I just got the Spirit. I mean, do you feel like you just got the Spirit? I kind of feel like it. It wasn't like that. It was like, whoa, Spirit came, we got it. And the Spirit of God showed up, and he entered into his people. 3,000 came to Jesus and received the Spirit that day. And a community was born. A community of God's people, filled with God himself, and suddenly a reality was birthed out of what happens when a community of people, a gathering of people, are full of the Spirit of God. Here is what emerges. And we see some things. These things are in no particular order. We just see them all as an unbelievable emergence in this story. First of all, we see an uncommon generosity born. Acts chapter 4 verse 32 captures this, where it says that the people had all things in common. So when anyone was lacking for anything, those who had any more than basically what they needed would give it away so that others would have. It was an uncommon generosity. We see further in the book of Acts, in those early parts, that people would regularly sell their inheritance, their future, their legacy, their land, and bring it to the apostles and say, here, distribute it, not only for this community, but for the work of the gospel and the work of God as it expands. There was an uncommon generosity born out of the Spirit of God in people. There was an uncommon boldness born. Remember this? I mean, John and Peter are before the Sanhedrin, right after the Spirit comes and they're preaching the gospel, they're called in, and the Sanhedrin with Caiaphas, the godfather of the high priests, and the high priest himself, Annas, there, the two guys that affected the crucifixion of Jesus, and they say to them, if you keep preaching the gospel, we will kill you. And Peter and John go, and we understand, it's a tough position for you to be in, but here's the deal. We saw Jesus come back from the dead. And then he rose into heaven and he said he was with us. So you go ahead and kill us. It's cool. Just so you know, we're leaving to preach the gospel. What? That's what happened. And they didn't even know what to do with them. So they're just like, go, just go. We'll think about it. Great negotiation. So they head out. They go back to the community, and you might say, well, that's Peter and John. That's different. No, they go back to the community of 3,000, right? And they get with those guys, and they go, hey, guys, listen. We're just with the Sanhedrin in prison. They told us they're going to kill us all if we keep preaching the gospel. And what does the community pray? Oh, God, rescue us from our oppressors and save us from the persecution of the... No, this is what they pray. Oh God, we know you're sovereign. This is your story. We're with you. So would you embolden us so that even in death we would preach more boldly the gospel? There was an uncommon boldness among the people of God. There was an uncommon unity among the people of God. Ephesians chapter 4, verse 32, again, it says, they had all things in common. In the book of Acts, it says they were of one heart and of one mind. Can you imagine this? Now, you might say, well, they were all friends. No. Remember at Pentecost when the Spirit of God came? He had to speak in multiple languages. Why? Because there were multiple languages present from all over Israel, from north, south, east, and west. They had come for the celebration of the Passover and the Pentecost. And so they were all there. They came from different towns, regions, cultures, language groups, and they were not particularly in common. And now it says they were of one heart and of one mind. They had an uncommon unity among them. They loved one another. They fellowshipped with one another. They did life together, absolutely. And then they were of an uncommon focus. Uncommon. It is almost as though this community abandoned their pursuits for the sake of whatever God wanted. And then whatever pursuits they did not abandon, they utilized as resources to better the community for the glory of God. They had an uncommon focus. Every circumstance, every event, horrible, beautiful, miraculous, persecution, it didn't matter. The very next set of realities after every event was, great, let's preach the gospel. Great, let's tell them about Jesus. Great, let's have people come to him. They had an uncommon focus. They were fixed on Jesus. They were fixed on the gospel. And the Spirit of God was at work in them. And we see an uncommon love born. A love that still to this day was so uncommon that it breached the geographical and cultural realities, not only from Jerusalem, but into their very enemy's world, Samaria, and then beyond that into, God forbid, the Gentile world. Those monsters who are pagans and hate God. You touch them and you're unclean. They breathe on you and you have to run. If you wanted to scare your child, you told them about the Gentiles. And these people went and preached the gospel to the Gentiles. This is what this uncommon love did. They also had an uncommon purity born, an uncommon purity. Ananias and Sapphira, that's kind of where it was born, right? In this community, when the Spirit of God is full in a community, then sin is going to be exposed. Darkness is going to be revealed, and you will be able to bring what is exposed to the community and go, ugh! And they will go, let's heal that up. See, in a community where the Spirit of God is full, sin has a place. Its place is exposure, and then healing begins. And so Ananias and Sapphira began and demonstrated very tangibly that process, that in this place you can try to hide, but it's coming. The Spirit of God will bring light to you. This was an uncommon purity that was born in this community. And then we get to chapter 5, verse 12. And an uncommon power seems to mark this community too. An uncommon power. The miraculous, the signs and wonders, the ability to overcome sin, to overcome darkness, to overcome obstacles, to overcome the realities that hound us, demonic oppressions and even sickness. Seemed to be a power that came with God that said, I can overcome these things. You see, when the Spirit of God showed up, the Spirit of God began to overcome everything that makes us us. He overcame our selfishness with generosity, our impurity with purity, our self-focus with unity, our obsession with our own stories with a focus on the gospel. You begin to see him just overcoming us. You see that? Overcoming us. And what emerges is no longer us. It is Jesus in us. He's making us like Christ. And that was the context in which the miracles had to fit. You see, what we discover in the early church of the New Testament, in the story of the church of God unfolding throughout Scripture, is that in this season of the church's life, miracles and wonders, though they were very present, were not central to the story. They were not. You don't hear anywhere in the book of Acts. The church was marked by the miracles, wonders, and signs. What made the church special were the miracles, wonders, and signs. What made the church stand out were the miracles, wonders, and signs. You don't read that. The miracles, signs, and wonders were a part of the church's story, but a small piece of a very large, extraordinary puzzle, a small piece of a reality that was born out of a people that were filled with the Spirit of God. And that's what we find ourselves functioning in. What does God do with a church like this? A church with uncommon generosity and purity and love and focus and boldness and uncommon things. Well, a church like this, see, a church like this, when that's happening to you, a church like this realizes that we must lay on the altar, we must be prepared to give to the work of the gospel our emotional, our physical, our financial, our relational, our social realities and say, they are yours to do what you want. We must risk ourselves for the gospel. This is the kind of church that understands that for God's kingdom to come, our kingdom must go. So we must die to our kingdom and come alive to God's kingdom. What does a church like this do in its culture, in its world? How relevant does a church like this become? Can I remind you? We actually know because we have the history. The Roman Empire is arguably one of the strongest empires that has ever existed on planet Earth to date. An empire that should not have fallen, that should not have had anyone be able to come and overthrow it. Do you know what overthrew the Roman Empire? It was not another empire. That's why after the Roman Empire, you don't have the next empire emerging. It was the gospel. The gospel creeped its way into the internal realities of the Roman Empire and brought it to its knees. The power of the early church of the New Testament brought the greatest empire known to man to its knees. It was not only relevant, it was central. And it became the power of God to carry the gospel into the world. It was this early church of the New Testament that carried the gospel into Samaria and Judea and into the Gentile world. It was this story that carried it beyond the borders of possibility. It was this story that changed the world and set the foundation for you and I to stand on. It was this story that brought us to where we are today. Do you want to be this kind of church? I mean, that's a valid question, isn't it? Do you want to be this kind of church? Do you want this to be our story, Mosaic, our story? I mean, I want it to be our story. Maybe I'll answer for you. I want it to be our story, you understand? I read that and I go, I want to be that uncommon. I want to be that insane. I want to be that crazy. I want to have those realities marking our church. You know, in the church in America, let me tell you how commonplace we have become. Do you know, statistically in the U.S. church today, they've done all these awesome statistics. I love our statisticians, and they've done their thing, and they've calculated that in the Christian population of America, they've actually divided it even between Catholic and Protestant. So, I mean, they've kind of got all these divisions. But in general, the Christian population of America, that the church currently in our current today gives 3% of its income to the work of God and social justice. 3% of its income. And it gets better. The 3% is given by 20% of that group of people. The other 80% just don't give at all. That's the church. Do you know what percentage agnostics and atheists give to social justice today? 4% of their income. We don't even measure up to the people that don't believe in God. They are more generous than we are as a church as a whole. And I would love to say, because we are a missional church here at Mosaic and we understand mission, that we rise above that statistic, but it's not true. It would be a lie. We run right about equal to that statistic. About 20% give 100% of the giving here, and that equates to about 3% of the total. Are we uncommonly generous as a church in America? No. We're not even commonly generous. Purity. Should we touch on that one? A good idea. We should. I think that answers the question, doesn't it? No, please, no, don't go there. It couldn't possibly be true that pornography is equally addictive within the church as it is outside of the church, could it? Oh, wait, no, it is. That's actually statistical, too. And we even lie, so it's probably worse. What about uncommonly unified? I think the church in America is uncommonly unified. No, wait, I'm sorry. Uncommonly disunified. Do you know how many denominations we have? Have you lost count? I have. I don't even know anymore. I don't even know. And you know what's really fun about our denominations today and our non-denominations too, by the way? It's not leaving those guys out. We became non-denominational because we were fighting with the denominations and didn't like them, so it didn't work out well for us. Here's the deal. Denominations don't even fight each other anymore. They just fight themselves. Isn't that fun? Oh, the denomination is fighting itself. It got bored with fighting all the other denominations. If the world looked into the church today and asked themselves, is there an uncommon reality in the church? Is it uncommonly generous or uncommonly pure or uncommonly unified, uncommonly focused, uncommonly bold? Yeah, bold, that's a good one. We developed friendship evangelism. You be their friend for 50 years, then you die. If there's an opportunity, maybe tell them, but tell them carefully, don't offend. Isn't that what we do? We walk around our workplaces like, I want to share the gospel, I really do, but I don't think I should, because you know, it's going to get weird. Boldness doesn't mark our lives. Timidness marks our lives. See, when we look at the church in this and we see these miracles and wonders and things and we go, oh, those sound awesome. Why can't we have them? Oh, do they belong to us too? Are they part of us? We should stop and go, whoa, let's not even start there. Let's start at the beginning in the right context. Have we become a church that is marked by the things that mark this church? No. How do we do that? How do we become a church marked by all this? See, miracles, signs, and wonders are a small piece of a large puzzle. And I think oftentimes what we desire is not God himself. What we desire is what God will produce for us that will be cool so we can be cooler than the rest of the people, right? So then we don't really desire things like, Spirit of God, rain fire on me. By the way, I would recommend praying rain instead of fire because it gets a little weird. Rain down on me. And fill me up so that power will be produced among this community. And then God goes, great, let's do some uncommon generosity. Whoa! Does that mean I have to give more? Yep. Can we rethink that story? I was thinking more along the lines of healing for the sick, because that's cooler. How about this? Uncommon purity. Let's reveal your sin. Wait, mine too? Yep, yours too. You mean the big stuff? Yep, the big ones. But everyone will know. Yeah, they will. See, we don't actually really want some of that stuff. What we want is the cool stuff God's going to produce. So actually what we want is not God at all. And we don't want God to work and transform us at all. We want what God can give us to make us more powerful and cooler and happier and more comfortable. We are like people with a genie syndrome. You know the genie syndrome? Maybe you don't. Maybe I made it up. I don't know. But here's the deal. You take a lamp. You rub the lamp and out of the lamp pops a genie. Do you care what the genie looks like? No. Do you care who the genie is? No. Do you want anything to do with the genie? Not really. What do you want from the genie? Three wishes. That's it. We don't rub a lamp so we can get to know a genie. Do you? I mean, have you ever seen a movie like that? Can we sit, have coffee, hang out? I have three wishes for you. I don't care. Never thought about the wishes. I just want to get to know you. No. See, but we deal with God that way, don't we? Don't we? We don't really want to get to know God. I mean, we do, but really, at the end of the day, here's the bigger question that haunts us. What do I have to do to make sure God provides for me? What do I have to do to make sure God does the good things for me, that I don't get the, you know, the bad stuff, the suffering, the sickness, the poverty, all those things that nobody wants? What is the formula by which I can prove to God that I'm right with him so he can do right by me? We want to know the Father because the Father provides what we want. We want to know Jesus because Jesus has the keys to get us into heaven. And we want the Spirit because the Spirit can do cool stuff. But we don't want God. We want what he has. And as long as we want what God has and we don't want God, we will never become this story, ever. But if we want to become this story, it's actually very simple. We have to become a people that desire God more than we desire what God offers. We want God because God is enough. We want God because God is everything. We want to know him just because we can know him. And we want the Spirit of God to come and to fill us with his power so that he can do what? Whatever he wants. Because we don't care what he produces. We care that we know him and that we have him and that he is with us. And whatever comes from that, if that means generosity at uncommon levels and you take it all, fine, awesome. I don't care. I just want you. If that means you have to expose my sin, great. I just want you. If that means miracles, signs, and wonders will come, great. That's awesome too. We have to realize as a church that in the context of miracles, signs, and wonders, there are some things we have to understand about them. One, we have to understand that miracles and signs and wonders, they come in rhythms throughout God's story as he sees fit to produce what he needs in his continual unfolding story. We see this throughout the whole story of God, Genesis to Revelation. There are seasons where miracles were just full and rich in every single moment. You couldn't turn left or right and not see a miracle. Remember Moses? Remember this guy? I mean, if you were hanging with Moses, you couldn't breathe without seeing a miracle. I mean, rivers were turning to blood and locusts were coming and he was turning sticks into snakes. And then there was the angel that came and people were dying. And then there was the Red Sea incident. And then there was a cloud. And then there was a pillar of fire. And then if you touched the ark, you died. And then there was, you know, lightning and thunder on the mountain and lightning on stones. And then the rivers parted. And then the walls of Jericho came down. And then they thwarted massive armies just because God confused them. I mean, it was like wherever you looked, you're like, whoa, just miracles. But then you get seasons in Israel's history where the miraculous was present, but it wasn't commonplace at all. In fact, you hardly heard anything about it. Then Elijah and Elisha come on the scene and miracles, and then it's kind of quiet. And Jesus is here, and it's miraculous, and the early New Testament church emerges, and it's miraculous, and then it kind of settles down. And then throughout church history, there are moments where we see God stirring and revivals happening and uncommon things being born, and then it fades out. Even in a personal human life, haven't you experienced that if you know Jesus? There's seasons in your life where it just seems like the Spirit is stirring everything. Seems like miraculous things are happening in you and around you. And then there are other seasons where you're like, I know I love God. I know he's here. But I don't know that it's, you know, particularly like thick with all the supernatural, insane things that go inside of us and outside of us. In a church's life, we should expect nothing less. There is no formula for miracles. There is no thing we do to produce them. Here's what we should know about miracles. They're part of God's story from Genesis to Revelation. They're part of God's story throughout history. They are part of our story, but they should not be expected to be commonplace all the time. By definition, they wouldn't be miracles then, would they? Miracles, by definition, are uncommon things. They are outside of the natural. If every time someone died, we could touch them and they'd raise from the dead, one, we'd have a lot of very miserable old people that are like 400 years old. Two, that would no longer be a miracle, would it? It would be uncommon. I mean, it would be very common. So miracles, by definition, should be expected to be very uncommon in a story, not common, but they should be expected to show up in moments when God wants to do supernatural things. They will be part of our story, but in uncommon ways. We should also be very, very careful with miracle signs and wonders because intrinsically, deep down inside, we believe, I know it because I do too, that if we could just produce a miracle, a real, genuine miracle, someone blind sees, someone sick is genuinely healed, or someone lame walks, then all the skeptics will believe. All the people that don't know Jesus will believe. If we could just produce a real miracle, if we could just show them a real miracle, like one of the big ones, not ones that we kind of have an x-ray and kind of work through, but one that a skeptic can't deny, then we would save our community. Don't you dare overestimate the power of miracles. Miracles are short-lived and they have very little sustainable power in saving anyone or anything. They save no one. We see lots of examples where miracles are produced, and even Jesus said, I mean, he could see miracles, that ain't gonna save him. We overestimate the power of miracles, be very careful. We underestimate the power of him who saves. It is not a miracle who will save anyone. It is Jesus who saved us through his work and the Spirit of God who awakens our souls. And miracle or no miracle, the Spirit of God will awaken the souls. And miracles may be produced, and if the Spirit of God doesn't awaken the soul, the miracle will be short-lived. It will be an entertaining process on a stage at best. Don't overestimate the power of miracles. Don't long for miracles to mark us. If miracles mark us, if they become central to our church, we've missed the point. What should mark us is the uncommon realities born out of a people that are full of the Spirit of God. Let's work toward being marked by those. And let's watch miracles appear when God chooses them to for his purposes and his purposes alone. So that does leave us with the final idea. Should we expect that in our story at some point we should see some miracles, some miraculous things happen? Yes, we should expect that. I think it would be right to expect that. If it doesn't happen, should we be disappointed? No. But should we expect that God can and will produce the miraculous in his unfolding story of our lives? Yes, we should. But we should equally expect that if the Spirit of God is full in this place and he is moving in and through us, that will be a small, uncommon part of what marks our story. What will mark us, what should mark us, is uncommon generosity, uncommon boldness, uncommon unity, uncommon purity, uncommon focus, uncommon love, and uncommon power. That should be our story. And if we're going to be a church like that, we are going to have to learn together not what it means to have the Spirit of God. We have the Spirit of God. When you come to Jesus, you have the Spirit of God. You are sealed by the Spirit of God. But how to live full of the Spirit of God. How to walk in step with the Spirit of God. How to have our eyes fixed on Jesus. And how to live uncommonly out of the empowerment of the Spirit of God. And for that, we have to become a church that learns together how to pray for one another regularly and for ourselves regularly. Spirit of God, come and fill us up with your presence and your power so we would live uncommon lives among the people. That's where we want to go next. Let's pray. God, would you just constantly keep our eyes fixed on you. Not what you produce, not what you give us, not what we get from you, but on you and you alone. May we become a people willing to risk our relational and emotional and spiritual and financial and social realities for the sake of the gospel. May we become a people that recognize that we have been given the privilege to be uncommon in the things that we do. But that those things will cost us dearly. We will be exposed. We will have to give. We will have to be bold. We will be risking things. But God, may we do that out of the power of your Spirit, because that will mark us as uncommon. And you've demonstrated in so many arenas in our life story that uncommon people and uncommon things draw the attention of the world. God, we confess to you that as a church, both locally here and as part of the American church, that we are not uncommon, that we are not extraordinary, that there are some extraordinary things about us, but that in general terms, if the culture were to look in, they will not see uncommon things in us. Forgive us for that. And rise up in us, Spirit of God, fill us with your power, that we might become an uncommon church. A relevant church, bringing the gospel of Jesus Christ to this culture. May you use us to be the ambassadors of that journey. Teach us, Spirit, what it means to be filled with you. Teach us to be full of you every day. And may we remember above all else that our freedom is not a result of miracles, signs, and wonders. Not a result of provision, not a result of things that you keep us from or things that you add to us, but a result of you rescuing us and restoring us. And may we be obsessed with wanting more of you, because Spirit of God, where you are, there is freedom. We love you, Jesus. Spirit, make it so. Amen.